You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And today we're going to do things slightly differently. We're going to have a conversation, and Godfrey Simmons has joined me here in the studio, and we're going to talk about what's happening. And this is going to be less of an interview about our lives and what we've learned, although that's going to be part of the backdrop. But it's going to be more of a conversation between a couple of men who've known each other, who have some significant differences and significant similarities. So that's the purpose today. So Godfrey, it's good to have you on the air.
Hey, it's good to be here.
So what I'm going to do, we're going to start with a little bit of music from Nina Simone, mm-hmm. and that'll set the tone.
Yes, it will.
So do you want to say anything before we play it, or do you want to just go there?
I guess... I don't know. I think the song speaks for itself,
right? And will I? What I hope to do is to tease out what are the connections and what are the disconnects, because we have some now in both directions. Here we go.
Our last tune, we had some requests for it. Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Can't you see it? I know you can feel it. It's all in the air. I can't stand the pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer. Alabama's got me so upset, and Governor Wallace has made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Hound dogs on my trail, school children sitting in jail. Black cat crossed my path, I think every day's gonna be my last. Lord have mercy on the land of mine, we all gonna get it in due time. I don't belong here, I don't belong there, I've even stopped believing in prayer. Don't tell me, I'll tell you, me and my people just about do. I've been there, so I know they keep on saying, go slow. That's just the trouble.
Too slow.
Washing the windows.
Too slow.
Picking the cotton.
Too slow.
We're just plain rotten.
Too slow.
We're too damn lazy.
Too slow.
I think it's crazy.
Too slow.
Plot. All I want is equality for my sister, my brother, my people, and me. You lied to me all these years. You told me to wash and clean my ears and talk real fine just like a lady, and you'd stop calling me Sister Sadie. But my country is full of lies. We all gonna die. Flies. I don't trust nobody anymore. They keep on saying, go slow. That's just the trouble.
Too slow.
Desegregation.
Too slow.
Mass participation.
Too slow.
Unification.
Too slow.
Do things. live next to me. Just give me my equality. Cause everybody knows about Alabama. Everybody knows about Mississippi. Everybody knows about Mississippi. God damn. That's it.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and we're doing things a little different today. We're just going to have an open discussion here with Godfrey Simmons about what's happening in our world and what how we might respond.
I love this version of that song because if it's the same one I'm thinking of, it's the video of it. You actually see, it's actually in front of an all white audience in like France or something like that, or in Europe somewhere, and she's literally like staring down the audience. At the end, she says, "That's it," and just like looks at the audience with contempt, and it like, kind of stands up.
Yep, that's the recording.
And, yes. You know, she does bow, but just she was just. I just feel like that she was just the most uniquely black artist of the last 60 years. She's just unapologetically black. She just was like, anyway.
Right. So uniquely black, unapologetically black. Just unpack that, because I mean, I think I know what you mean, but
yeah. I mean, because she was. She had all of the technical, the classical, like mastery of what, you know, the European classical tradition and mastery of, you know, jazz and the blues and all the stuff that was her birthright.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think it's all her and our birthright, but in terms of just like looking at it, and so, but she was a race woman. She was, that's what I mean by unapologetically black. She was a race woman. She was someone who with every single thing that she did, whether it was something that was like this song, which mm-hmm, was mm-hmm. very political, or black is the color of my true love's hair, you know, the mere fact of her doing it and the way in which she did it, it becomes a political statement,
right,
even though it's an old Scottish or Scottish / Appalachian ditty.
Yep.
You know, it's yeah, I mean that's and then of course there's all the cultural stuff, like in what she did artistically,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
that was all like in terms of that, her art, it was black.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at its, you know, in both its highest and lowest forms, if whatever that means, but yeah, I guess that's what it means. She could get the vernacular, she could get the physical, visceral.
Yeah, and you're using low form in terms of that, elite music thing. In terms,
yeah,
because it's not a moral judgment.
No, not at all.
Because I come from the other spectrum, you know, and where people were, you know, I grew up around a lot of mocking low forms and mocking kind of poor white music, and I grew up in an environment where I didn't understand that All in the Family was satire.
Wow.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I mean, yeah. It's just partly because there's an earnest sensibility that I have that just kind of needs to be broken through with a jackhammer at times. But other than that, it's just a place where, you know, that and what I liked about what you what I connected to about what you said was unapologetic.
Yeah.
And there was a time in the 60s when there was this unapologetic presence of people like Nina Simone and the guys who won at Mexico City who held up the Black Power right. sign and then lost their medals
right.
because of that. It's just unapologetic. And it's a bit in your face, but it's not demanding much of you. It's just there. And that's and that was, you know...
It's taking space.
Yeah. It was occupying the space that they... owned.
Mm-hmm.
Not any less, not any more.
Yeah. And I think the issue is that I think that there's today a lot of us who occupy it in a way, occupy that space without having to kind of announce it because it's ingrained in us because of what we learned from people like Nina Simone mm-hmm. and, you know, Smith et al. From Mexico City and,
and also Malcolm X.
Harry Belafonte and Malcolm X and James Baldwin.
Yes, and less Martin Luther King Jr.
I think Martin Luther King Jr., look, he... I don't think less. I think he took as much space as any as anybody.
Yeah, yeah.
Here's the thing.
Yeah.
If he wasn't the person here, we know how much space he took. Because of how dangerous he was, like, to the powers that be.
Right.
And then in taking him out, like, he was taking space. Once he, and if we go with, like, all the stuff that we know that mm-hmm. was going on with the personal life mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, the philandering and the, you know, whatever... other stuff that was happening, and he was still doing that work.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that to me is actually taking space. And then
he was living like three lives.
Well, yeah.
I mean,
But the most important thing is that, like, getting together the March on Washington, and I know that Bayard Rustin was the main architect of that. But Bayard Rustin, another person who took space. What that did is that it was one of the first times since Bacon's Rebellion in like the late 18th century, 17th century, that, you know, poor whites and black people and people from all across the cultural spectrum were brought together in an organized way.
Mm-hmm.
This was before even Fred Hampton was doing his stuff in Chicago. Which is why they took him out like quickly. And so that was taking space, to a different level
mm-hmm.
in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah.
I think sometimes we kind of like slough off Martin Luther King Jr. into some other kind of, you know, corner that we slough him off into a non-revolutionary corner at our peril.
Well, yeah. I mean, there are several ways such a big icon gets distorted. One is to lose sight of his deep religious identity and appropriate him as a secular icon,
right,
which is a complete misappropriation.
Yeah.
And through much of and even through what, you know, his philandering or whatever issues more conservatives would want to raise about that, there is a profound connection to evangelicals that we've lost.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the way that's been kind of
mm-hmm.
taken off to the side. So the way it's in a certain sense, though, and I grew up responding more to people like Malcolm X
mm-hmm.
than I did to Martin Luther King Jr. And partly that's because I grew up in a more cooperativist, almost not socialist, but, you know, the reactionary white rural area with people kind of in that tradition. And I also identified with some of the liberation theology movements of that era.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, a different piece for me. So let's walk it forward.
Okay.
What I connect to with those people who occupied space unapologetically, completely, without occupying other people's space, is that they were forces to be reckoned with.
Yeah.
And who are the forces, or what, you know, who are the forces to be reckoned with now? And how can we engage each other at this time so that we have something else going on other than just this Trump tweeting and edicts that are kind of capturing our attention in a reactive mode?
Who are the people who take space? I have no idea. Yeah. I have no idea, Eric. There are plenty of people who were like taking space and who are, you know, in my mind, I don't know, they all seem old. But older than us. I mean, like,
yeah.
Maxine Waters, John Lewis.
Right.
And I know that there were a lot of young people who were out, you know, in the streets and who are, you know, leading and, you know, I think Black Lives Matter is doing incredible work, and that's, you know, young people, 35 and younger, and I am like lead on. I'm behind you 100%. I don't know about the taking space part in this age, because there's so much stuff to figure out about how all of this happened, about like how we got to where we got, because there's a narrative that is being kind of you know, pushed forward that, and even by people of color, which just drives me batty, and I'm just not understanding.
So tell me the narrative that as you
hear. The narrative is that, like, this all happened because we forgot, that everybody forgot about the white working class, or that, like, well, that's it. Basically, the last was that's what everybody's saying. It feels like that it's like, you know, well, we forgot about either white working class or rural people. It's like one of those two that, like, you know, we forgot about those people. and so that's the narrative, and that's why that's why Trump is like president. Okay. And then, I'm just like, there is nothing about this election that was not about number one, white male supremacy, and number two, just white supremacy. There is nothing about this election that was not about that. You can parse it any way you want. You can kind of like go like, well, there's this and then there's this. That at the end of the day, there is nothing about this that wasn't about that. It's just like all the moves that kind of led up to providing the landscape for this improbability right, to happen right. were sowed, you know, in the last 6 years.
Yeah, I guess so. I see it sowed in the last 50 years, but not the narrative about rural or working class.
Right. But what I'm talking about is I'm talking about specific moves mm-hmm. that were designed for this very for this very outcome. Now, I honestly don't think that the GOP thought that it was going to be someone like Trump.
No.
I think that, you know, was the ultimate thing.
Yeah.
But this is how these things happen. And I just think that we have to, you know, it's like we're losing sight of the target. We've utterly lost sight of the target.
Okay, so tell
me. The target being white male supremacy. That's, I mean, like, we've lost sight of that thing that's actually happening. And I think that that's to me, the real tragedy of the election. It was not the tragedy of Hillary Clinton. Those weren't the tragic mistakes that were made. They could have, because this could have been changed. Like, this could have not happened. The tragic mistake was Bernie Sanders. Like, that he made the tragic real mistakes.
How so?
Well, he had the opportunity to actually pull Dr. King, not just invoke his name.
Right.
He had the opportunity to actually pull Dr. King and actually ground a poor people's campaign around brown, black, and white people.
Right.
He made a calculated choice that ended up extraordinarily destructive. A and B kept him from winning the nomination.
Right.
Like, right. And then was cavalier about not, you know, engaging black voters. Like, actually made kind of cavalier remarks about it, as if they weren't nuanced voters, when in fact we are the most nuanced voters. We have to be, because our lives depend on
right,
it.
Right. You have to know exactly which direction the wind is blowing from and which degrees it changes.
It's like that's just like not understanding the history of the United States. It's just anyway, I've said a lot, but
I don't think whether Bernie had run a different sort of campaign. Had it been Bernie versus Trump, I'm not sure there would have been any different outcome. This is not a materialist analysis. There's just been kind of a long run of a certain kind of, whenever we get 50.1% in power, we use that to kind of push our agenda, and we've gotten a lot of distance off of coercing each other. And, you know, it's kind of, we forget that, you know, the EPA was a product of a Republican administration, was fairly progressive at the time, because we've come so far down this right. path of coercing each other and pushing us back and forth across some imaginary line that the hostility level is just so high. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't rural or working class whites that got Trump in. It was
no.
It was different. It was suburban whites.
Yeah,
you know, and
but people, that's not the narrative.
Right? Like, no, people are saying that. And it's also rural people who have just kind of gotten fed up with doing this dance that we've done for the past 50 years, and not feeling like, you know, the whole politics of inclusiveness, which is kind of bogus on some level, because people aren't occupying space like Nina Simone did, or like, you know, the people that we talked about earlier. When people occupy space, then inclusion becomes real differences that really have to be reconciled and worked with. And when we haven't had a lot of that, I think, which you were saying, who's occupying space?
You know what? But I tell you who's occupying space. Sure. Who's occupying space right now
right.
are white progressives. Like, the last actually who occupy the space of speaking toward progressive, like, values. Like, that, they do occupy space. And
who are they?
And I think it's people like Chris Hedges. I think it's people like, I think it's like, you know, Democracy Now, it's... There is, I think, Cornel West, unfortunately, in my mind, but he just bothers the heck out of me.
Why does he bother you? Yeah.
Well, first of all, what is the deal with that scarf around your neck? Anyway.
Cornell was kidding. One of my seminary professors.
I'm kidding.
After he finished his doctoral program, and he showed up in a 3-piece suit with a gold watch.
You know? What? That's all great. The scarf, I just can't. It's just unsettling. No, I'm kidding. I'm not kidding that it annoys me, but that's not really what the problem is. The issue, because it's a larger issue, because it's not just Cornell West.
Right.
The people who are occupying space don't understand their own privilege. And that was the problem to me for the entire, like, last 18 months of the election, is that these white progressives, Susan Sarandon, like, people who were, you know, saying things and acting in ways and condoning things that if you turn the volume down, you'd be like, well, they're just doing exactly the same thing that these, like, the things that were said about Hillary Clinton, the things that were, like, the ways in which, like, the rage and it was no different than, you know, Republicans or the GOP or, like, you know, raving conservatives. It was like, and then the biggest, my biggest issue in terms of the space that white progressives were taking up during the election, mm-hmm. is that you had a conversation. So I'll get a personal. So I'll have a conversation. I'd have a conversation with people, and I would say, look, you know, whatever you think about Hillary or the Democratic Party, really, to me, like, not voting for her is like literally kind of voting for my extinction.
Right. And you and I had that exact conversation about a week or two before the election.
Right, right, right.
And I just said that she doesn't get it. She fundamentally doesn't get it and is not up to this of up to the task of leading.
But here's the thing. Yeah,
but you but said...
Yeah. My point is that, like, but that... the problem in my mind in terms of white progressives is that they don't understand that they have the privilege to be able to vote for whatever the heck they want to. And it won't they, at the end of the day, they'll be okay. And it was a lack of fundamental understanding of that. Even if someone says, like, okay, I get it. The people who did get it, in my mind, mm-hmm. were actually the liberals. Because they, the white liberals, DNC didn't ruin that election for Bernie Sanders. It wasn't a DNC. It was his own idiocy about how he, like, ran his campaign, as great as it was.
And he also didn't really expect to go as far as he did. I mean, again, we had two candidates.
No, he didn't
expect to go as far as they did.
He didn't. Yeah. But, and I guess my thing is that, like, if you, even if you just said, like, I understand, I'm going to be okay. Like, that's half of, like, what I need.
Right.
But you wouldn't get that when you were having conversations with white progressives. You wouldn't get that at all. There was no acknowledgement. You hear people like Chris Hedges or Sarah, Susan Sarandon or some of these other folks on, you know, like, you know, with their kind of, you know, with, you know, on these interviews, and like, you'd be like, you do understand that, like, that this, the way this affects people is, it's different for you. You're going to be, there's no world in which you are going to be affected by this. There is no way in which your life will really be touched by this. And so, or at the end of the day, you will be spared. Like, this is what we're talking about is mythic. And there's a fundamental misunderstanding that I think that right now white progressives aren't really kind of dealing with. They are actually, like, looking at them in the mirror at that part of it.
Right, and they're not willing to stand shoulder to shoulder in conversation across that brown, black, white
right.
conversation
across yes.
the political spectrum.
Right.
And all, with all of the stars that came out for Hillary and that and, uh-huh. so, and refused to go out for Trump, you know, in terms, you mm-hmm. know, that we have fashion retail politics where we're just not standing and occupying substantial space with each other,
right?
Which is what you're saying.
Yeah.
And let's take a music break because I want to.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah.
What should we play next? We have a few more Nina Simone pieces up.
And, oh, let's see.
Young, Gifted, and Black. You've got Revolution. We've got Strange Fruit. We've got.
Let's do Strange Fruit. Okay. Let's go really happy.
Okie doke. We will. yes. And what I want and I mm-hmm. we're gonna go very, yeah. We're gonna go to Strange Fruit, and then we will go from there.
Southern trees. Barren, strange fruit, blood on the leaves, and blood at the roots. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant South. Them big bulging eyes and the twisted mouth. Scent of magnolia, clean and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh.
It deals with America and the black and white problem, really. The ugliness of it, that is about the ugliest song I have ever heard. ugly in the sense that it is violent and tears at the guts of what white people have done to my people in this country. I mean, it really, really opens up the wound completely well when you think of a man hanging from a tree and to call him strange fruit. Here is a strange and bitter cry.
Was Nina Simone and Strange Fruit. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Godfrey Simmons. So, Godfrey.
Yes.
Where do we go from here? I don't, you know, all illusions notwithstanding.
Yeah. Where do we go? I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, I think that old canard, I think you have to, at a certain point, there has to be some stepping aside of, you know. So, you know, with the Women's March, there was this whole thing where it first been arranged. It started out as an idea among, I'm sure there were other people who had the idea and just hadn't been really public about it. But it just happened to be two white women who kind of on social media had, like, you know, suggested something like this, got together, and then there were complaints about, like, you know, why is it only white women who are, you know, organizing it? And then the white women were like, yeah, actually, I think that's a good idea. And then, like, you know, a diverse crew of women were brought into the leadership of it and started coordinating it, and, you know, and then it was happening, and then there were, you know, still toes getting stepped on, you know, both ways, and then you had white women really kind, you know, saying, you know, well, why is it, you know, a big deal? I feel like with the, you know, rhetoric, I feel turned off by the rhetoric,
right.
It was instructive. It was really instructive to kind of, like, watch that happening, because I think that that's, again, it's just like at the end of the day, it still comes down to that original sin, to the color line in it. It comes down, you know, to this utter misunderstanding that this is all a setup. Like, the whole thing is a setup. Let's put the people who have not against each other to therefore keep our power. And I do think that, you know, for the most part, that's something that I think people of color who've been in this country for a while really, truly understand. I think there's some folks who don't. Maybe some. I think there might be some people from some immigrant communities, you know, maybe you know, from the maybe from like, you know, the Caribbean or some Latino countries that like maybe it kind of are, you know, have a different kind of take on that. But I think essentially there's an understanding like that that's the setup. And the problem is that it feels like there are very few white progressive leaders that actually understand that fact. And A, and B, there's not enough of us, people of color, talking about that very thing. I mean, I'm sure there's some, and I'm not right. hearing it, but it's usually like in like, you know, it's you know, it's not on blast. It's not like, and we can't get out of like the, we can't get out of this, you know, voting on emotion and this. We was like, we can't kind of really look at the situation and really think clearly. Like, oh, I understand exactly why a candidate, Barack Obama, could not, running for president, to be the first black president, I actually understand why he couldn't actually say he was for gay marriage. He would never have gotten elected. I actually know that, I can actually look at it and go like, I know that to be true. What's the strategy? You know, and it's, so it just feels like that there's a lack of understanding of strategy. There's a lack of understanding about like being able to talk about what's been set up, how we're like
right.
being kept apart.
Mm-hmm. But
now maybe I'm wrong.
No. I want to play, because I think that's a really, I think, you know, Obama's handling of that particular issue
uh-huh.
was probably one of the most deft pieces of political maneuvering of his entire presidency, because as a country we had a number of states weigh in on gay marriage mm-hmm. With popular votes. We had a number of judicial rulings and eventually ended up with a Supreme Court ruling, and we have addressed that issue in a way that it is not biting back at us the same way Roe v. Wade has.
Right.
And partly, I mean, and both issues became popular flag-waving issues in the late 60s, early 70s, abortion and gay rights. Mm-hmm. And the first one of gay attempt at kind of making gay rights a public issue got really stamped down, and Anita Bryant
yep.
was behind that with Tom Harry. Who was the guy? A singer who did a very funny spoof on her. I squeeze yours, Anita. You squeeze mine, Anita.
Oh.
About her being the spokesperson for the citrus growers in Florida.
Exactly.
Anyway, so all I'm doing is saying that I remember this time, literally.
Yeah.
We lived through this time. But what happened was we were able on some level to deal with a number of issues around gay rights and addressing gay and lesbian issues more directly than we did with Roe v. Wade.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that was that Roe v. Wade was justified in a way that went beyond the facts, beyond the, because it was justified by the creation of a right to privacy, which had never been articulated before, and at the same time we were creating the notion of a personhood, of corporate personhood, which was also brought under this right to privacy. And these two issues have really hobbled us mm-hmm. tremendously. A woman's right to choose is not necessarily the same as a right to privacy. And a lot of cultural conservatives who would have been on the bandwagon around a right to choose, and especially a really, and the public has had a constant understanding about the nature of choices around abortion, those opinions have varied very little over the past 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
But we have not figured out how to acknowledge that we can have morally different approaches to a common problem.
Mm.
And that part of the way people play us off against each other mm-hmm. is that they say, you got to agree to this strategy. rather than saying, we're going to have multiple strategies, it's whatever works for each community, and we're going to stand in solidarity with each other as we take morally offensive different strategies to try to accomplish the same thing.
Right. And that's, and like, if there's anything that seems like anti the progressive movement right now, it's like different strategies. It's like there's like one way, there's like one way to do it, and it's just kind of like,
and it's gonna fail.
And
it did.
Yeah, and it's just kind of like, you're sitting there thinking, you're sitting there thinking to yourself, like, is it just me? I don't think I'm any smarter than anybody else. And I think there are a lot of people, and a lot of people that I talk to in the black community that I know, not in Ithaca necessarily, and I mean some in Ithaca, but just, you know, all over the country, we were just kind of gobsmacked. We're just like, this is not rocket science. Like, this election is not actually like some, there's no angst here. There's no kind of like equivalency. There's no, it was like, and the problem is that like what people weren't wrapping their brains around is that what was successful about the Obama years, and I do think mm-hmm. that they were successful, is that he embraced the different strategies, knew that there were different strategies that were going to have nothing to do with them, and in fact, I think, lent his support to those different strategies. I think, in fact, opened the door and literally said, I need you to do stuff. I need you to, like, push me. I need you to kind of do things. I can't just do this. And then when it really became apparent that, like, you know, them white boys in, you know, Congress weren't going to let him do anything. Mm-hmm. You know, what happened is that, like, the reason why, like, the, you know, gay marriage thing was, like, powerful, like, there were gay, powerful white men who were affected by it.
Right.
That's, and I hate to just kind of name that, but I think that that's mm-hmm. really true. That was a part of it. The other part of it is that the strategy was so clear on several different fronts, and that was not on the radar of, like, you know, of Bernie Sanders or the people who were supporting him. It was not it just, and I think that's what the thing that I actually love about, you know, the promise of, like, the movement for Black Lives, I think, is that there is a sense of, like, embracing some different strategies and saying, like, hey, we're kind of doing this. You all are going to do, you know, can you all do, you know, do this? Yeah, we can do that. I'm thinking about Surge.
Mm-hmm, sure.
You know,
standing up for racial justice.
Yeah, and all of that. The beginnings of, like, a unique understanding of that. And but I gotta tell you, it's just like when you listen to young people, I'm talking about like late teens, early 20s, talk right. about this stuff in ways in which they're not understanding at all about, like, the historical.
What are some examples of that?
Oh, well, it's just, you know, you'd hear them talk about Hillary Clinton and, like, kind of swallowing everything about her without, like, investigation or
positive or negative thing about
her. Usually negative. Right. Yeah.
But she carried the younger vote.
Yeah. Which is still shocking to me. Utterly shocking. Mm-hmm. I think there was a thought that, like, of sitting out mm-hmm. the election, that this sitting out this election was like a viable option. And it is, I think, obviously, it always is. I'm not saying that, like, it's your, you know, you like have to vote. But it's hard for me to see you out there protesting.
If you didn't
vote. If your butt didn't go out there and vote. Right. Like, it's the height of hypocrisy. It's, you know, you are responsible. Any blood that is shed through this, it's on your hands.
Right.
And I think that's the kind of thing that you were kind of hearing from young people. And I'm not saying that, like, I think, you know, I'm not saying that they're smart. They're brilliant. They're, you know, it's on the one hand, you don't want to, you know, be ageist and say like, well, they don't know any better. I actually think they know a lot. They probably know more than we do. I'm constantly amazed by that. But then on the other hand, it's frustrating to kind of go like, how did you miss what this effect was going to be on you? On you specifically.
Right. I guess, and I guess for me, it's the bigger question is how did people not see this kind of tide turning? I've felt like this has been in the works for at least since 1971 or 72. And I did, you know, I did work in over around the creation and control of wealth in rural and urban areas. Mm-hmm. And I watched in the mid 1990s, if there had been any alternative to the Democratic Party, the people in the poorest neighborhoods of color in Detroit and Chicago would have gone there because the Democrats hadn't served them for decades. Mm-hmm. And in terms of any fundamental notion of changing their lives,
right,
or being a party on to express or explore the possibilities of those lives.
Yeah.
And so it didn't come as a surprise to me, but it did to a lot of people. And that, I think, is just, you know, in religious terms, that's a sign of idolatry. When you fail to see reality clearly and it smacks you.
Yeah.
It's called idolatry.
Huh.
You know, you were looking at something that didn't exist. You were seeing something that wasn't real. You were valuing something that wasn't working.
Yeah.
And you got smacked, as you were saying. And I guess, how do we... My intuition has always been that we need to listen and act across differences where we do not expect to be in lockstep.
Mm-hmm.
And this is maybe even more because I think there have been times when I have been invited out of conversations among progressives because they didn't trust that I wouldn't share what was said in environments where it wasn't welcome. But, you know, and I when I know stuff is confidential, I hold on to it. When I know that it's open, but for the most part, as a culture, we need to know how we're all organizing, so we can know more clearly how to organize in response. And this that didn't happen in this election.
No,
those conversations did not happen.
That's and I guess that is my point.
Yeah.
The moment that like Black Lives Matter like stormed the stage of like those women stormed the stage at that Bernie Sanders, but he needed to sit down with them and like have like several conversations with them up and like, and because he was the person that was going to make sense to have those conversations from a point of, from a real sense of authenticity in terms of, you know, what he's talking about in terms of the economy, what he's talking about. I mean, that's just an example. I think there are a whole bunch of other examples out there, not just that. But I think you're right. I think that there was an utter lack of.
And Bernie did not know how to not be intellectual. Politics is always primarily and fundamentally about our visceral, physical reactions and emotional reactions, and the intellectual part is just the, and it's either the cream on the top or the things that opens the, cracks the nutshell when you want when to break open an issue. But very little of our substantive political effort is intellectual, and he couldn't get out of it.
Right.
And that's elitism in a certain way, but I, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
You're absolutely right. I mean, it's tough.
I what I'm wondering and what I'm gathering from this conversation is that neither one of us, you know, we see, you see in the movement for Black Lives, Black Lives Matter, and SURGE standing up for racial justice. You see movement in that direction. What I would like to see would be some real honest mea culpa on the part of progressives and liberals, that we set up a situation where we couldn't deal with the real diversity, which I think is moral. And it's not cultural, ethnic, it's not religious, although religious as much as it pushes moral buttons.
Right.
But we don't really believe in diversity. And if we did, we'd organize to see that people's needs got met on their terms.
Right.
And we're not there yet.
Absolutely. And the shocking thing to me is that, like, more of, in my personal window, which only means that, I found that the liberals were actually more interested in those different modes than progressives were. And that felt like a betrayal.
Didn't have a champion on that front.
What do you mean?
They did not have a champion, a person to push. We need a tent that really recognizes the actual realization of differing ambitions that may be at odds with each other. It may have a different understanding of what it means to be black or Latino or white or a woman in a particular context or a man in a particular context where you might need and want supports that are contrary to other settings.
Right.
We didn't get that.
You mean from liberals? Right. Do you feel like we got that from progressives?
We didn't get it from anybody.
Yeah.
And the liberals may have been willing to entertain it. I think kind of the petri dish that could have taken hold
in.
But it didn't take hold because there was nobody to really cultivate it.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely.
Godfrey, it has been wonderful to talk with you this morning. What should we close with here? So we have some Nina Simone. We have Young, Gifted, and Black. We have...
Let's go,
Revolution.
Young.
We have.
Let's close with Revolution.
Okie doke. Here we go. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh shoot. Maybe we'll do both. I don't know. Hey, we're in the middle of a revolution because I see the face of things. To come, yes I do. Oh, your constitution, well my friend, it's gonna have to bend. I'm here to tell you about the destruction of all the evil, it will have to end. Just to stay alive.